Chair calls this meeting of Judiciary Committee to order. First order of business is the minutes of April 3rd. Do I have a motion to approve the minutes of April 3rd? Representative Barr moves the motions, the minutes of April 3rd. Any discussion? Seeing no discussion, all in favor say aye. Aye. All opposed say no. Motion passes. Yes, we do have a quorum, Representative Carlson. Then we're just, the only thing we're doing today is the approval or the walkthrough of the spreadsheet. The walkthrough of the omnibus finance spreadsheet and the language. So, and then we have, we're going to take public testimony as well. We have 1, 2, 3, 4, like 8 testifiers thereabouts. So why don't we get started? Mr. Walls, you're going to get us, oh, by the way, some of you got sticky fingered with the budget books, so we don't have all the budget.
It was me, I wrote back.
Yeah, but there was one or two more that were missing. We knew you brought yours, Representative Barr, so if you have a budget book somewhere, bring it down, because we need all of them. But I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Walls to get us started off, and can you tell us what we're looking at, Mr. Walls?
Mr. Chair, you should have a, and members, you should have a spreadsheet that's, I believe, in the back of your green folder today. And starting on page one, we will begin with the budget for the Supreme Court.
This one right here?
Mr. Chair, yes, that's
okay,
correct.
Okay, everyone, this is what we're looking at. At your green sleeve, your green translucent sleeve, the last one is the spreadsheet that Mr. Walls is going to start us off on. Thank you, Mr. Walls. Go ahead.
And Mr. Chair, I would just say there are some areas that are lightly shaded, and those are essentially changes that were inserted by the committee that are in addition to what's in the governor's budget. So, Mr. Chair, beginning on the Supreme Court, on line 5, we have a 3.3% salary increase for the employees and a 3.3% salary increase for the judges. We also have $213,000 the first year, $501,000 the second year for insurance costs. We also funded the governor's request of $2.5 million for cybersecurity needs at the for the courts. But on line 9, we add House File 1784, the neutral evaluation study, for $50,000. Mr. Chair, there's no change to the governor's request in civil legal services, so we add, the same as the governor, $1.6 million the first year and $2.5 million the second year for an increase in civil legal services. Mr. Chair, moving down to line 21, the Court of Appeals. Again, we have 3.3% for the employees, 3.3% for the judges, and requested insurance costs. On line 32, the district courts, we have 3.3% for the employees, but the bill also includes a slight increase for judges in the district courts only, and that is 4.4%. So, where the governor provides $5.5 million for that that request, we provide $7.3 million. On line 38, we have the requested insurance costs. We have on line 39 from the governor's budget the gun violence prevention money. On line 40, mandated psychological services requests at $1,070,000 per year. On line 41, we have dollars for 2 additional judge units in the district courts, and on line 42, the request for treatment court sustainability of $306,000 per year. Mr. Chair, moving down to the guardian ad litem board, there's their operational adjustment, which would include salaries and insurance. They had board development training on line 51 of $135,000 per year. On line 52, technology upgrades of $200,000 the first year and $50,000 ongoing. And Mr. Chair, on line 53, compliance with mandates, and this would add several positions for the guardian. Mr. Chair, moving to the tax court, on line 61, they had a request for e-filing and remote helpline. That was funded at $125,000 per year. On line 66, the Uniform Laws Commission requests an operating increase of $5,000 per year, and that was granted. On line 72, the Board of Judicial Standards, we provide the governor's request for an operating adjustment, $41,000 the first year, $20,000 in the second. And also on line 75, an online complaint update for $5,000 in the first year only. In the Public Defense Board, we add on line 82 an operating adjustment. On line 83, there's some new staffing to help with their workload. On line 84, there's a small increase of $82,000 the first year and $166,000 the second year for public defense corporations. And on line 85, the committee includes an additional 2% increase on a one-time basis for the Board of Public Defense. On line 86, we have House File 1971, and that provides $205,000 the first year and $515,000 each year after that. That is for additional public defenders to represent people who are indigent and are at risk of having property forfeited. On line 90, the Human Rights Commission, we provide the governor's request of new One Minnesota positions of $1,500,000 the first year and $1.6 million the second year. On line 94, an operating adjustment would be for some salary increases and some insurance increases. On line 95, a software update for their on-base software at $75,000 per year. And on line 96, we provide funding for a bill that is traveling separately, that is House File 1500, non-compliant driver's licenses. This would be for one position to do compliance work for that bill. On line 101, the Legislative Coordinating Commission, we add $7,000 per year for House File 1404, a commission on intelligence and technology. Mr. Chair, that brings us to the last page. There is, on line 105, Mediation Services Bureau. We provide the startup money for House File 1,115, the Cooperative Divorce Program. That's $2.2 million the first year and $413,000 the second. And, Mr. Chair, revenue changes in the bill are for a few different provisions. We include House File 1060. This is allowing the court to waive the criminal traffic surcharge for the indigent. There is a cost to the general fund of $868,000 the first year and $1.1 million thereafter. There is a slight revenue loss to the game and fish fund of $3,000 the first year and $4,000 the second. We have on line 1791 a revenue loss due to civil forfeiture of $218,000 the first year and $238,000 the second year. Mr. Chair, on line 116, we have House File 113. And this would try to put Ramsey County on an equal playing field with other counties as far as fine revenue. That would cost the general fund $405,000 per year. On line 118, we have House File 2743. This is a civil and probate filing fee increase. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. I think I mixed up the line number, so I'm going to back up. On line 113, the Ramsey County fine revenue is a loss of revenue to the general fund of $129,000 the first year and $173,000 the second year. On line 117, we have a court data breach prevention fee. The dollars are raised to help the courts pay for the cybersecurity money that is requested through the Supreme Court of $2.5 million a year. But to meet our target, we only needed a blink-on and then blink-off fee of $1, which for 2 years, which raises $405,000 each year in fiscal 20 and fiscal 21. On line 118, the civil probate filing fee increase to $335. Mr. Chair, I believe this is a $50 increase. It raises $5 million per year. And that fee would that fee increase would be ongoing. And then, Mr. Chair, on line 121 for cooperative divorce, due to the changes in that bill, there's a slight revenue loss to the displaced homemaker program. And so the bill transfers $10,000 in fiscal year 2020 and $20,000 a year thereafter to make that fund and that program whole. And, Mr. Chair, that those provisions would put us at our target for this biennium and in the tails, and I would answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Walls. Are there questions for Mr. Walls? For Representative Barr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On line 83, new staffing under the Public Defense Board. Both the governor's budget and the House budget, the 2021 is about three times as high as 2020. Can you explain why that's such a huge increase from the 2 years, please?
Mr. Walls.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, was that was on line 83, is that correct?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, I believe it's just a phase-in of the hiring and fitting with the governor's budget. I wasn't in on those discussions, but my guess would be that they only had so much money to spend in this biennium and in tails, and so they hire a few people in the first year and then bring on several more in the second. And I could look up the number of positions in the budget book, but it would take me a second, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Well, Representative Barr kept his budget book, so I assume he studied it over the week.
I haven't gone completely. I don't have it memorized, but I have read it.
Well, you should have it memorized by now, Representative Barr. Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question was also for staff, so I'll let them answer the first question first.
Oh, okay.
Since he's looking up now.
All right. Well, go ahead, Mr. Walsh.
Mr. Chair, in the Board of Public Defense, they have a change item called Maintain and Stabilize Public Defense, and I broke that out onto separate lines. One of those is entitled New Staffing. The FTEs from the budget book are 75 the first year and increasing to 108 in the second.
Okay. Is that good, Representative Barr?
Yep.
Okay. Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering then, these spreadsheets, to me, are missing a couple of columns, and that's comparing it to last biennium's numbers. And so if Mr. Walls could just tell us what this new budget is over base, and then also what it's doing in the tails on a compared to last biennium.
Oh, Mr. I'm sorry. You're waiting for me to say,
he's
Mr. Walls?
It up.
He's looking it up. We're good.
Mr. Chair and members.
We don't usually have last biennium columns on these spreadsheets, do we? Chair Scott?
This is last year's. It's got previous.
Okay. All right.
Mr. Chair and members, for the fiscal 2018 and 19 biennium, the total spending was, and this is all general fund, was $939.9 million. The 2021 general fund base, before any additions, is $956,200,000. The governor's recommendation is $1,047.6 million. The governor's tails are $1,069.5 million. The House spending is $1,055.6 million for 2021, and the House tails are $1,076.3 million. Those numbers that I recited are not our targets for either spending or tails. Our targets are based on net impact on the general fund, and so the spending is a little higher but is reduced by new revenue to meet those targets.
Thank you.
Okay. Chair Scott?
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions for Representative O'Neill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this is more just a question for you, a clarification. On line 42, you have the treatment court sustainability. I'm assuming that was supposed to be for the five treatment courts that will be losing their funding from the federal grants that they all have. That's two in Anoka, one in Wright, and Olmsted, I believe, is the other. And I know we had Wright County come in and kind of show that what their budget was, and it exceeded $100,000 per year. And I see you have $306,000. So just doing quick math, that's not quite even enough for three of the five courts. Just wondering if I'm missing those numbers, or did you get something else from the Supreme Court that that's all that they needed, or just clarification?
Representative O'Neill, as I recall, this was the request that came directly from the courts.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't add anything else on top of what they requested. I know there was some back and forth. I don't know if the courts are here to describe to state what their plans are for sustainability beyond that, based on what the numbers are. But if they are, well, did you want to speak to that, the state court, Mr. Chair, Mr. Shorba?
Thank you.
Good morning.
Hello, Mr. Shorba. Thank you.
The funding formula that we have in the courts. We give each court a little different number than they had in the federal grants. Sometimes the federal grants are much larger than what our funding formula does. A funding formula is based on the number of participants, and it's generally going to be funding the treatment court coordinator's salary plus some other expenses. So we worked with each of the courts on the numbers, and it might not match their federal grant, but it should be sufficient to sustain the court.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the five courts that will be dropping off of their federal grants, this the $306,000 per year is enough to sustain all five?
All five.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions for Mr. Walls before we move on to Mr. Johnson? I have a question, Mr. Walls, and I should have thought of this before. I should have asked you offline before, but I'm going to ask you in public. So all these spitball and fiscal notes that we get, based on cost for bills or even agency estimates. Has the OLA ever audited years later of what the actual expenditures were for a bill to find out if they were accurate, over or under?
Mr. Chair, to my knowledge, they have not. In some cases, that would be easy to do. In other cases, depending on what issue area you're talking about, it could be difficult to do to find out whether or not the fiscal note was accurate in retrospect.
Okay. Oh, thank you. I was just curious because I know in talking about the backfilling of this Displaced Homemakers Fund, which we're replenishing with the private cooperative divorce. One of the advocates for cooperative divorce was Andy Dawkins, and he was one of the folks who helped create that Displaced Homemakers Fund, I think, in the late 80s. And the idea was there were still a lot of women who were at home in a divorce. After a divorce, they don't have the education or skill set. This is supposed to help them get back on their feet. I don't think it was ever used for that, I think ever. And it's being now, I think it's been used by HHS. I don't see Chair Liebling here. But it's been used by them for I don't know what, and I don't think it's been used for what it's. So that's one of the things I'm asking about. There's this kind of this shell game that goes on. So I just put it out on the record because if anyone in this room knows the answer to that, if there's ever been an actual evaluation of the accuracy of fiscal notes thereafter, I've been wondering about that for a while. Chair Johnson.
Chair Lesh, I was sort of wondering the same thing. It'd be interesting to see how accurate they are, especially since we've now started our own legislative board doing these bills, to make sure that they do them properly and promptly and get the accurate information so we can do these bills justice.
Thank you. Any other questions for Mr. Wallace before we move on?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Walls, on line 93, could you tell me how many FTEs are in that new One Minnesota position?
Mr. Walsh.
And then, and in, while you're looking, line 96 as well. Oh, that's just one. I guess you'll explain that. Sorry.
Mr. Chair, Representative Robbins, in the Minnesota Department of Human Rights budget page for transformational budget, A Path to One Minnesota, it lists 17 positions each year for that request. And I'm sorry, was there a second one on top of that?
Mr. Robbins? I just forgot
that you'd answered it already. Sorry, thank you. Sorry.
Thank you. Any other questions for Mr. Walsh? Okay, thank you. Mr. Johnson is going to take us through the other items.
Thank you.
Yeah, bill language. Oh, language itself. Okay. So, Mr. Johnson, can you tell us we're going to be on the bill language itself, right? So the A-19 amendment?
Correct, Mr. Chair. It's coded A-19-0359. Should also be in your packet with the in the green folder. Article 1 is essentially the spreadsheet put into words in other ways. I want to highlight only two provisions in Article 1. The first is on page 3. That deals with the new trial judges. The courts have indicated that their need is in the 7th Judicial District, and so this places those two new units in the 7th District. The second thing to highlight is...
Before we move on, I was wondering... if I could ask the committee if anyone has been approached by anyone else regarding needs for those judges anywhere else but the 7th. I mean, I've heard from several folks about the 7th, that it's important in the 7th. That's where the Supreme Court wants them. That's where everyone I've heard from wants them. Is there any other concerns about that from committee members? Okay. Thank you. Go ahead, Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, moving to page 4 briefly, this is related to the new positions for the Board of Public Defense. There is rider language tying those new positions to the public defenders appearing in Veterans Specialty Courts. I'm moving on to Article 2 now, which begins on page 5. This article has a variety of provisions that deal with the courts. Sections 1 and 2 are from the Chair's House File 1060. This is the bill that permits courts to waive the $75 criminal traffic surcharge if the court finds that the fee would cause a hardship to the defendant. Sections 3 and 4 are on page 6. These are the fee adjustments, also from the Chair's bill. This was House File 2743. This is slightly different from the version that appeared in committee. The civil and probate filing fee has gone up to $335. The cybersecurity fee has gone down to $1 and also now has a blink-off provision after 2 years. Section 5 is also from House File 1060, the criminal traffic surcharge waiver bill. Section 6 is on page 9. This was Representative Becker Finn's bill that adjusts the percentage of fine revenue that municipalities in Ramsey County, other than St. Paul, can receive. This places those municipalities on equal footing with all of the municipalities in the state except for those in Hennepin County. Section 7 is another provision from House File 1060. Section 8 is on page 10. This is the final section in Article 1. This was Representative Cantrell's House File 1748. This is the provision that involves an early neutral evaluation study and report. There are two small changes to this from what the committee heard. There's a slight change clarifying the status of data. It simply includes a cross-reference to the term summary data. It doesn't have any other significant impact. The second change is that the bill included the word must in relation to the courts, particularly the Supreme Court. We've replaced that with is requested to. The courts are a co-equal branch. We generally offer them money and ask them to do things.
Mr. Chair, if I could interrupt real quickly, if you could just let us know what line that is on the bill.
Ms. Johnson?
One moment, Mr. Chair.
Must peak is 1025.
It appears in a few places. I'm hearing it starts on 1025. That is correct. 1021 in relation directly to the Supreme Court now says the Supreme Court is requested to.
Thank you. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members, that's the end of Article 2. If there are no questions, I'll move on to a brief overview of Article 3.
Any questions on Article 2? No, seeing none, thank you. Please move on. Oh, Chair Johnson.
Chair Lesh, I can't remember if there's any funding that goes along with this provision, but I would suggest one amendment that if the courts do not do that, they do not get the funding.
Okay, well, there's 50 grand attached to this, Chair Johnson, but if they don't do what?
If they do not do the request the study, that they do not receive the funding.
Okay, well, that's... Yeah, I mean, that. I thought that was... Go ahead, Mr. Johnson. You explain the way that
Mr.
works.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, this is $50,000 to perform the study. That language is in the rider.
Thank you. Okay. Go ahead, Mr. Johnson. Article 3.
Mr. Chair, members, moving on to Article 3, this is the forfeiture provision. It begins on page 11 and runs all the way through page 38 of the bill. This was House File 1971. The language that is in the bill is the same as the language as amended by this committee. You may remember the committee removed the DNR from the original version of this bill. This version also removes the DNR. On a very high-level overview, this repeals all of the existing forfeiture provisions that are in Minnesota law, except in relation to the DNR, and replaces them with a new system. There are costs involved. Mr. Walls discussed those costs, in particular in relation to the public defenders. There will also be some revenue to the general fund generated by this change. We have not yet received an estimate of what that revenue is, so we can't speak to that at this point. Mr. Chair, that's the end of a very high-level overview of Article 3. If there are no questions on that article, I'll ask you to recognize my colleague, Mr. Hopkins, to begin the walkthrough for Article 4.
Any questions on Article 3? Seeing none, then thank you. Mr. Hopkins, please start us off on Article 4.
Mr. Chair and members, Article 4 contains various items of civil policy and data practices policy.
Well, Mr. Hopkins, what page does it start on?
It starts on page 38, Mr. Chair.
Excellent. Thank you. Go ahead.
Section 1 of Article 4 is the Legislative Commission on Intelligence and Technology. This is from House File 1404. It's a bipartisan commission that will study, investigate, and oversee issues related to emerging technology, government surveillance, and individual privacy. Section 1 starts on page 38 and runs until page 40. Section 2 of Article 4, this is from House File 2362. It's a data practices provision dealing with data, grant data held by the State Arts Board. The State Arts Board has a slightly more transparent process than a lot of other grant-making agencies do, so they needed to make certain grant data public at an earlier stage than is typical. So for the State Arts Board, grant data will be public during the public review meeting that they have rather than at the completion of the evaluation process. And Mr. Chair, Ms. Mullen will take the next few sections.
Thank you, Ms. Mullen.
Chair and members, Section 3 of Article 4 begins on page 40. This is Representative Cantrell's bill related to assisted reproduction. It updates the use of the term. It previously only dealt with artificial insemination, which didn't cover the donation or use of ova, and it has been updated to include the rights and responsibilities of parents in those cases. Section 4 starts at the bottom of page 40. This is the sexual harassment update to the Minnesota Human Rights Act. And this is Representative Moeller's bill. Section 5, this is a bill from the Human Rights Department, which says that if a closed case went through the Department of Human Rights administrative process, then after that, either party can ask for those records that are held by the Minnesota Department of Human Rights. Section 6 begins on page 42. Section 6, 7, and 8 are from House File 2000 and 2001. These are two bills related to the Minnesota Department of Human Rights and their workforce compliance certificates and their equal pay certificates. There are technical changes made, and there are also an expansion of cities and counties who are receiving general obligation bonds to use those workforce equal pay certificates. I think Mr. Hopkins has section 9.
Excellent. Thank you. Any questions on Ms. Mullen's section? Go ahead, Mr. Hopkins, on section 9.
Mr. Chair, on page 43, this is actually section 8. I think sections 8 and 9 on our summary got reversed. So section 8 on page 43, this is a data practices provision dealing with human rights data. It provides that data that the Commissioner of Human Rights receives regarding workforce certificates of compliance are private or non-public. These deal with certificates of compliance showing that a business has an approved affirmative action plan for purposes of contracting with a government entity. The commissioner's final decision regarding a certificate of compliance would, however, be public data. And Ms. Mullen will continue.
Thank you. Go ahead, Ms. Mullen.
Chair and members, Section 10 through Section 14, these start on page 44. This is Representative Herr's bill, which prohibits marriage for individuals under the age of 18 and prohibits the recognition of marriages for Minnesota residents under 18 who marry in other jurisdictions. And it makes other technical and conforming changes to that section of law. And the final section of this bill is all one bill. It's Article 5, which is a cooperative divorce program bill. This begins on page 49, and it establishes a cooperative divorce program in the Bureau of Mediation Services. And there are no changes to the bill that was heard in committee other than including the financial provisions that had previously been blank.
That's everything.
Is that it? That's the whole thing. Okay, questions from for the staff, from members. Representative O'Neill.
Just really quick, Article 5, what House file was that and who was the author?
Well, it was my bill. I don't remember the bill number.
Okay, thank you. That's all I need.
1115.
Thank you.
Other questions? Okay. Then the next we're going to do is, that was seriously everything. We're just burning through this. Okay. Public testimony. So test, oh. I did the Minnesota, oh.
Oh.
Okay. First, we've got Commissioner Lucero. Welcome back to the committee. We are limiting testimony to 2 minutes each, members, because we burned through that so quickly. I might be a little bit more liberal with that. Big surprise, since I'm a liberal. Welcome to the committee, Commissioner Lucero.
Good morning, everyone. Good morning, Chair Lesh. Thank you for having me today. So, yes, my name is Rebecca Lucero, and I'm the Commissioner for the Department of Human Rights. I will not take the entire 2 minutes, so I'll be brief, but I do want to thank you all for your full support of the budget request for the Minnesota Department of Human Rights. This budget allows us to work together through partnership with local communities to be the catalyst for the transformational change we're all working on towards a strong Minnesota. We look forward to deepening our impact across the state. Obviously, we work in every single county across the state, but we're particularly excited about deepening that impact and that partnership in Bemidji, Worthington, and Duluth. I also want to thank you for thank the committee for your support of our four policy bills. So HF 2000, which is Representative Lee, covers all bonding projects under workforce certificate and equal pay certificate requirements. HF 2001 is Representative Cantrell, and that clarifies language in the workforce certificate statute. HF 2004, that's Chair Lesh, allows for access to unredacted data by case parties who file in court. It's a really important provision for parties who are looking to move forward on their own. And HF 2062, which is Representative Dean, classifies workforce certificate data as private or non-public and clarifies that. So I really appreciate all that support. I also just want to at least make sure I call out one bill, which is HF 10. That's Representative Mueller's bill reforming the severe or pervasive sexual harassment standard. The omnibus includes this important step to make sure all Minnesota workers have the legal protections they need to be free from sexual harassment on the job. This is a really important and timely step, and I appreciate the support of Representative Mueller's bill. So I know we're all going to have some busy days and long nights ahead, and I want to thank each of you for your work and your partnership to ensure we are investing in a thriving Minnesota. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Commissioner Lucero. Representative O'Neill.
Just a quick question. Could you, since we've got you here, could you clarify what the 17 FTEs were again for the new one Minnesota positions?
Yes, thank you. I appreciate that opportunity, Chair Lesh, Representative. So it actually is 13 full-time employees, and that's a change. So we are in looking to partner specifically on the ground in Bemidji, Worthington, and Duluth, and so we would like to have staff that are there on the ground to help. And we have an office currently in St. Cloud that does that work, so it would similarly expand. And that's primarily what it is. There's also one full-time employee that we currently have on staff that we have funded through a grant with the foundation that does outreach. She's amazing. We would really like to keep her work.
Thank you. Representative O'Neill.
So just to be clear, it's just the same functions as all your other offices. You're just doing satellite offices of the same?
Yes.
Commissioner
Thank
Sarah.
You.
Excellent. Any other questions for the commissioner? Chair Scott.
Thank you. So I'm confused. So you had the spreadsheet shows or the budget items show 17 FTEs. You're going to have 13 in satellite offices and another one. So that's only 14. Do we need to make a change to the line item or to just allow for 14 FTEs? Or what are the other three?
Who? So you're asking that of Commissioner?
Yeah.
Commissioner, can you answer that? Maybe we can have staff answer that too. Go ahead.
Chair Lesh, thank you. Yes, I'm going to defer to Scott to answer that. Mr. Butel.
Mr. Butel.
Thank you. My name is Scott Butel, Assistant Commissioner with Minnesota Department of Human Rights. Thank you, Chair Lesh and Chair Scott. Regarding the FTE, in the governor's initial budget proposal, it also included a Rochester regional office. When he did the revised budget, that was scaled down, so that went from 17 FTEs to 13. I think in the spreadsheet it might show 17 now because the budget provision around an operating adjustment, that would allow us to preserve four existing FTEs. So for the 13 for the transformational ask, that actually is inclusive of maintaining that position of the one individual who's currently grant-funded. But because it goes from being grant-funded to general-funded, that's counted in that number.
Chair Scott?
So I'm still confused. Are there three? Are we over three? Do we need to change that line item to the testifiers? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Butel?
Thank you, Chair Lesh and Representative Scott. I believe the depending on how fiscal staff is doing the count, I think the maintained FTEs for the operating adjustment, so we've got 13 for the transformational, so that would be 12 new positions, one additional position transfers from being grant funded to being general funded, and then under the operating adjustment, we maintain those four positions that we would lose without an operating adjustment.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Other questions for the commissioner? And Mr. Butel, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, everyone. Have a good day.
Thank you.
Next on the list is, what? Which one are you pointing at? What about Max Hall? So Anna Odegaard traveled far. Okay, so we're doing that one first. Okay. Ann Hofgren and Drew Schaefer. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you to all members of the committee. I'm Drew Schaefer from Minnesota Legal Aid. This is Ann Hefkin from Legal Services of Northwest Minnesota. We just want to thank you for the opportunity to briefly speak with you this morning. We first just want to thank you for your careful consideration of the Civil Legal Services funding request, and we thank you deeply and sincerely for your support of our funding requests and our efforts to deliver on the promise of equal justice for the Minnesotans we serve statewide and whose rights we protect.
The funding included in your bill will help civil legal providers across the entire state of Minnesota face the challenges of unavoidable increased health care costs and also be a preliminary step in our help to help us with our compensation deficit that we face when compared to other public interest and public sector employees.
So we appreciate all of your hard work, all of the time you've spent on the issue at hand regarding civil legal services. We look forward to working with you going forward and to answering any questions you may have. Again, thank you.
Excellent. Thank you, Ms. Hofgen and Mr. Schaefer. Any questions for either of them? Representative O'Neill.
Mr. Chair, what line item is it that we're funding I'm not finding.
Well, that would be on the first page, right? Oh, yeah, first page, line 13. Starts on line 13, Civil Legal Services.
Thank you.
Yep. Okay. Any other questions? Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next, we got Max Hall with Ask Me. And Anna Odegaard is on deck. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Hall.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. For the record, my name is Max Hall, and I represent Ask Me Council 5. We represent more than 43,000 state, county, and city employees in this state. I'll keep my comments brief, like the previous testifiers, but I do want to comment on the funding levels provided for the Guardian Ad Litem Board. And so thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, for including the governor and the board's full request for the Guardian Ad Litem funding. Many of you have probably heard of the Office of the Legislative Auditor's report on the Guardian Ad Litem Board, and they offered a lot of recommendations to the Guardian Ad Litem Board, and I'm sure Administrator Treblehell Burzma will comment on that further, but they are making a lot of strides to accomplish those recommendations, and part of that is to increase the amount of staff to cover the unaccompanied children in courtrooms that the OLA report highlighted. And so that's highlighted on line 53 of the spreadsheet, compliance with mandates. But with that, Mr. Chairman, I will conclude, and thank you for including that. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Hall. Questions for Mr. Hall? Chair Johnson.
Chair Lesh, that's not a more of a comment. I was just going to say with the Guardian Ad Litem Board, we looked very closely at the OLA report last year, and we did fund those positions. Unfortunately, they were vetoed.
Understood that. Duly noted, Chair Johnson, you did do that and did your duty. Thanks for doing that. So hopefully we'll get it done this year. Any other questions for Mr. Hall? Thank you very much, Mr. Hall. Next, Anna Odegaard, and on deck is Nancy Haas. Welcome back to the committee, Ms. Odegaard. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Anna Odegaard, and I'm the legislative advocate for the Minnesota Asset Building Coalition. We're a coalition of 140 nonprofit organizations across the state who work directly with low-income Minnesotans. I'd like to thank the committee for including the provisions from House File 1060 in your omnibus bill, and I'd especially like to thank Chair Lesh for authoring and championing this bill. House File 1060 gives courts discretion to reduce, waive, or offer a community service option in lieu of the $75 state surcharge that is added to all traffic and criminal violations. As you know, a broad coalition has worked on and supported this bill over the last 3 years, including the city attorneys from Minneapolis and St. Paul and the state public defender, as well as community organizations from across the political spectrum, to name just a few: Voices for Racial Justice, the Justice Action Network, the Second Chance Coalition, the Minnesota ACLU, and the Joint Religious Legislative Coalition. Speaking on behalf of the Minnesota Asset Building Coalition, we support this bill because our members work every day with clients for whom that $75 surcharge is a true burden. The surcharge drives the cost of most basic traffic tickets well over $100, which our lowest income clients simply can't pay. Giving judges the discretion to consider ability to pay in the imposition of this surcharge will lead to a lower default rate, fewer collections cases, and we believe add an additional measure of integrity to our criminal justice system. Thank you again to the committee for recognizing the importance of judicial discretion over the surcharge in cases of indigency, and again to Chair Lesh for advancing this reform.
Thank you, Ms. Odegaard. Any questions for Ms. Odegaard from members? Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Oh, Chair Johnson, do you have a question?
Again, more of a comment. I understand this situation. The surcharges are way too high. They've gone up to the point where a lot of officers just quit writing tickets. I understand the need to have some waiving of it, but I'd rather just be able to waive just $50 and get the $25 back to the post board to keep that, which is taken in a special revenue fund, which is taken out in the public safety bill. But the importance of that public safety bill, that $25 surcharge, was to keep the post board neutral. So not at the whims of the legislature. That money was put there by statute to provide a steady stream of income for training our police officers.
Duly noted, Chair Johnson. You and I have been around here for a while, and I think reasonable minds can disagree as to whether dedicated funding sources are a good thing or not. I can guarantee you, I see the courts up there, I can guarantee you they think they deserve a dedicated income stream, and I think more than anyone else coming up here, they probably do, because they should not be held to the whims of what we do up here. Roads and bridges have constitutionally dedicated funds. Everyone who comes up here wants constitutionally dedicated funds. We could constitutionally dedicate everything, and then we all go home. But I don't know. I know what you're saying. I kind of feel like it is our job to evaluate this stuff every year, and I think that the post board should be funded through the general fund. I think almost everything should be funded through the general fund, because I think it's our job to evaluate it every year. I realize if I was in their shoes, I wouldn't want to be evaluated by us every 2 years. But I hear what you're saying. Any other questions for Ms. Odegaard? Thank you, Ms. Odegaard. Nancy Haas, and then on deck is Liz Richards. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Haas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Nancy Haas with Messerly and Kramer here today on behalf of the Minnesota District Judges Association. Wanted to thank you for the judicial court, the district court judicial pay raise and the two new judgeships in this budget. We know budget decisions are really challenging, and we appreciate the work you've done in this area. This recognition of the need to attract and retain the best and brightest judges, along with the diversity of experience and expertise, is sincerely appreciated and will go a long ways to achieving our goals. So thank you very much. We look forward to working with you through the rest of the session.
Thank you, Ms. S. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you remind us again what the gun violence prevention new line item is going to be for, the $162,000?
Is that for?
It's under district courts.
Well, yeah, but so Ms. Haas is here representing the District Judges Association.
Yeah.
So the district court's question would be properly placed, I think, to Mr. Shorba.
Okay.
Did you want to ask that of him?
That would be great.
Okay. Mr. Shorba? If you can just restate the question. Line item for gun violence prevention.
Line item 39, $162,000 each of the years.
Ms. Shorba.
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill, this was part of the governor's recommendation, not a court recommendation, so we did not develop this proposal or take a position on it, so I really can't elaborate more than that on it.
Okay. Well, my bad. I thought it did come from them.
It didn't come from us.
It came from the governor. It's a gun violence piece. And maybe research can speak to it.
Or is there anyone here from the governor's, maybe, since he's got that in there?
Okay. So it's, if Mr. Johns, can you explain, this is not a rider, but it is for the gun bills. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, members, this is an amount that was included, excuse me, in the governor's budget. There was a rider in the governor's budget that dedicated this money for what we're referring to as the red flags bill. That rider is not in this delete everything amendment at this time. The money does remain in the budget, but without a rider, it does not expressly say that it must be used for that purpose.
Okay.
Chair, now I'm more confused. So why is it in here if we don't have any rider language and we don't have anything in your bill about House File 9?
Well, I imagine, Representative O'Neill, because if we didn't, the courts would look at us like, what do you want us to do about this? If that bill passes, the courts would come back to us and say, great, another unfunded mandate. So I think that's the reason why it's in there. We can keep them accountable. We don't know that the gun bill language is not anywhere near this committee. It is solely in Representative Mariani's committee, and you know, that's his deal, or they're sending it on their own, which whatever they decide to do.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So in Mariani's committee and his omnibus, it's not in his omnibus, but we'll see what happens after today. But I just wanted to get that on the public record, what that money was for, and that those provisions are not in your bill. Those provisions may or may not be in Mariani's bill, depending on where it goes from here. But I think that conversation is important to have, since you are carrying this in your budget bill here. So.
Fair enough.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? The next, Representative Robbins.
Thank you, sir. So I just wondered, if the red flag language does not ultimately prevail in the legislature, does this money stay in the bill? And if so, what would it be spent on?
What's that? Okay, Mr. Walls.
Mr. Chair, Representative Robbins, the money that was requested by the governor for this provision, it represents an amount of work that the courts feel that they would have to do in serving these orders. And so if the money is given to the courts and the bill passes, but the bill remains silent on what the purpose of the dollars are for, the courts would have the money available to spend on that purpose. If the bill does not pass, and I'm speaking of the red flag bill does not pass, the money still goes to the courts and they could use that for whatever they have needs that would be satisfied by that money.
Representative Robbins? Okay, thank you. Representative O'Neill.
Sorry, now I'm a little bit more confused. So if the courts came up to testify that they didn't work with the governor, how do we know that this is something, this is the amount that the courts need to implement this when there wasn't a conversation?
No, I think I heard, Representative O'Neill, that there was a conversation. I'm assuming, like, I think this was vetted, like, what would you need? And that's what, why it went into as being a part of the governor's budget proposal. So that's
so when
what,
I, oh, sorry.
No, go ahead,
Representative O'Neill. Thank you, Chair. So what exactly do the courts need it for? Is it additional judge time? Is it additional staff time? Is it some other infrastructure that they need? I'm not clear as to what we're spending it for.
Does research want to speak to that, or does research have an answer for that, or does Mr. Shorba have an answer for that? Go ahead, Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair members, Mr. Walls is pulling up the fiscal note at this point to find out exactly what it was that the courts indicated they would need that cost for. I believe it is for additional staffing. It may include a judge unit.
Okay.
Mr. Walls may need a minute to find
Let's give him a minute to just look question. At that on the it's in our budget book too, isn't it? In our budget book?
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Walls.
The fiscal note for House File 9 shows a cost of $162,000 a year to the Supreme Court, and I'm not seeing any FTEs on the fiscal note, and I'm trying to scroll down to their narrative.
Why don't we do this? You know, you guys do whatever you want on this, we got between now and tomorrow when amendments are due or whatever. Let's get an answer between now and then. Oh, do you have it, Mr. Walls?
Mr. Chair, the fiscal note references the amount of case filings, and it says that 1,577 cases would need to be filed annually statewide for the bill to require one judge FTE. So the provisions of this bill are not required to are not anticipated to require an additional judge FTE statewide. According to the judicial branch weighted caseload data, it would require 173 minutes of court staff time. Based on the average court staff minutes per year, 539 cases would need to be filed annually. The cost of an FTE for a senior court clerk is $81,000, totaling $162,000. So they are putting in for two court senior clerks, although there's no FTEs noted on the fiscal note.
Okay. Representative O'Neill, you good?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That helps at least to give some understanding as what we're paying for, since it is in your budget. And I just was curious because I know that, like they said, the rider language isn't in your budget, and the bills are right now not in the omnibus bill of public safety. We will see what will happen this afternoon, but I just wanted to know what we're paying for. Thank you.
Fair enough. Thank you. Ms. Richards, welcome back to the committee, Ms. Richards.
Thank you.
And on deck is Bill Hutton.
Chair Lesh, members of the committee, I'm Liz Richards, the Executive Director of the Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women. I'm here to testify in opposition to the Cooperative Private Divorce Program, which is at Article 5, Section 4. Over the past decade, the coalition has been part of discussions and has supported a number of reforms in the family court. but we can't support this bill, and here's why. When you're considering reforming the family court system around divorce, that includes changing the system for divorce cases where there's domestic violence. The levels of violence and control that can happen during a divorce case are high, and the impact can be devastating. Just this year, we have two separate instances of domestic violence homicide within divorce cases. In December in Blaine, Mary Jansen was murdered by her husband, Matthew. She filed for divorce a little over a month before the homicide. She was actually killed in January. And when her husband was apprehended by the police, he said he didn't need to worry about the divorce now. In February in Hubbard County, Candy Gucci and Heidi Kurtzer-Pierce were both murdered when they went to pick up their sister's children from daycare, murdered by their brother-in-law. The police reports indicate that the murders rose out of their sister's divorce. So in 2016, when I was first aware of people working on creating this alternative system for divorce cases, a way to move divorce out of the court system, away from judicial oversight, we raised our concerns about safety and our concerns about the coercive control that happens within divorce cases. The authors have added in language to caution people, but that does not address our concerns. A written notice does not change the potential for harm. Telling people to consult a professional when there is no readily available, affordable professional does not address the potential for harm. So I'd ask that you would oppose this bill. Thank you.
Any questions for Ms. Richards? Ms. Richards, I have a question for you. Mm-hmm. What is the additional harm that you're proposing would be caused by allowing divorcing couples to agree on the terms of a divorce?
Chair Lesh, members of the committee, what the system does is it basically creates a system where if you have somebody who is a employing coercive control of tactics within their relationship, filing for divorce, it creates a system by which they could work out, supposedly, an agreement with their spouse, file it within this system with no oversight by anyone to see whether there was indeed coercive control being used, whether the agreements supposedly reached between the parties are really in the best interest of the children and the family. That's the concern. And so the bill creates this packet that has to be given to people. The only place this is addressed is a general, under the cautionary things, is a general statement that says, you know, doesn't even really call it domestic violence, but says that if you're feeling pressured, you shouldn't be using the system. That's not a meaningful way to really evaluate and screen whether there are people who are being coerced into following this route, into agreements that aren't in the best interest, really, of themselves or their children.
Well, Ms. Richards, what are you proposing is the kind of oversight that the current system provides that this system wouldn't provide?
Chair Lesh, in the current system, you have a judge who actually reviews each divorce filing that comes through. So even if parties, as you said, parties can reach agreement currently and file that with the court. And if the agreement that is being reached appears to be fair and in alignment with public policy, courts are signing off on those. What this does is it removes that oversight in the procedure.
Well, Ms. Richards, in the current system, do you know how many divorce cases that divorcing couples actually appear in front of a judge?
Chair Lesh, all cases, whether the parties personally appear or not, are all divorce final agreements are reviewed by a judge. So 100% of the cases are.
Well, Ms. Richards, I would note that these agreements or these stipulations that go before a judge aren't evaluated to determine whether or not they're completely one-sided or not. They're evaluated to determine whether or not the parties have agreement and there's some consideration for it. So do you agree that agreements that go in front of a judge could still be very one-sided?
Chair Lesh, there are obviously there are some agreements that go through that where there may be coercive control and people have been pressured into agreements they don't believe are in their best interest. But when you have judicial oversight, we also know that there are cases in which that has happened, and judges, by looking at the agreement between the parties, it's clear in the face of the agreement that this is not in the best interest of the parties, and it appears that there's been that it needs further review. So I'm not saying that 100% of the time that these cases are caught in the current system, but there is judicial oversight, and there, judges are asking further questions when something comes before them that appears that there may have been that an agreement has been reached that really does not appear to be in the best interest of one party or the children.
Well, Ms. Richards, I would simply propose to you that it's a heck of a lot less than 100% of the time. A whole lot less. And as a person who went through a divorce, and as a person who has handled divorces, I can tell you quite often parties reach agreements for various reasons that are one-sided favor one party, but they've reached agreement for reasons that aren't written into the stipulation or not. So I would just propose to you that the simple act of allowing divorcing couples not to shell out tens of thousands of dollars to attorneys, I guess I don't think it's a good enough reason to say that some of these things might come through that aren't fair, because under the current system we have a whole lot of them that come through that either aren't fair or one party decides 5 years later isn't fair. So I would just throw that out there. Any other questions for Ms. Richards? Thank you very much for being here, Ms. Richards.
Thank you.
The next testifier we have is Bill Hutton with the Minnesota. Oh, Representative Considine. Sure, Considine, did you have a question?
I did not.
No, he didn't. Okay. Mr. Hutton, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, my name is Bill Hutton. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Sheriff's Association. I'm here representing the Law Enforcement Coalition that is made up of the Sheriff's Association, the Chiefs of Police Association, the MPPOA, and the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. I'm here just to put on the record that as an association we continue to oppose the forfeiture bill. It's a very complicated bill, and we're asking that we can push pause to continue the conversation about forfeitures in the state of Minnesota.
Any Thank questions you. For Mr. Hutton, Sheriff Hutton? Yes, Representative Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Hutton, having read through this, I see the complexity is, and I'm no expert on forfeiture as it currently exists. Can you propose, I mean, just in the spirit of kind of cooperation, what would be some ideas in terms of taking some time to look at this further? What would be some suggestions that maybe you could offer in terms of what that might look like?
Mr. Hutton?
Mr. Chair, Representatives, I am not an expert on it either. I will let you know that I've worked in law enforcement for 33 years. I was a sheriff, elected sheriff for 12 of those years, and forfeiture was helpful to law enforcement in solving crime, if you will, or stopping crime is probably a better way to say it. So there are several things I believe that we can talk about that will continue to allow for law enforcement to be able to stop crime or interrupt crime, if you will, that are laid out there. Specifics, I think it would be best once stakeholders get together and have those conversations.
Thank you, sir.
Mr. Hutton, or Representative Cantrell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your service in law enforcement. In terms of the asset forfeiture bill, I just want to, for my understanding, gain a better kind of comprehension of are seizure and forfeiture the same thing, and are we conflating the two in this kind of dialogue that we've had around this bill?
Okay. Mr. Hutton.
Mr. Chair, Representative, good question. I'm sorry, I think they are getting confused as well, and there are some, if I'm understanding the question correctly, and again, law enforcement officer, not an attorney, so I believe that may be best asked of an attorney for getting those confused, meaning a seizure and forfeiture.
Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I recall some of the testimony on this bill when we heard it before, and I believe Superintendent Evans could explain some of those details maybe to us. I see him today. I don't know if he knows I'm even talking about him right now. I'm like, Superintendent Evans, I'm wondering if you would
angry birds.
Come down.
Well,
sorry, you
so,
were you winning?
The question, Mr. Superintendent Evans, we don't put people on the spot here. The deal is just that seizure is when you take my stuff, and forfeiture is when you file to keep my stuff. But if you want to go into more detail about the distinctions, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Representatives, I apologize. You have a lot going on as the legislature today. We were discussing some amendments in a different committee. So certainly when it comes to the seizure of the actual contraband, I know we've talked about that in this committee, the actual seizure would be us, the government, taking control of whatever the contraband or the item or the money or the property in that situation. The forfeiture, from our perspective, in the way the law operates, would be when we initiate the actual proceedings or forfeiting the actual property to convert the owner of whatever that property would be to the government.
Ripson Mullick.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think one of the things that concerned me when we heard this bill last time, there was a chart that showed drugs and guns and money seized, and I think the money was what was one of the concerns. And I'm looking at the bill, line 18.23, and that talks about currency, and I'm concerned about in those situations, for example, where you have like a drug house and you go in, and you find a lot of cash, if this bill would prevent you from being able to seize that cash as evidence of a crime.
Mr. Evans.
Representative Mueller, Mr. Chair and members, I do think that this bill creates a number of challenges when it comes to currency in particular related to these crimes. I think that the pieces, without having the bill directly in front of me, the pieces that talk about that it needs to have a direct connection to the underlying crime that you're investigating at the time, and it needs to be without process in that situation in connection with a lawful arrest, as outlined in the bill, creates a number of challenges for law enforcement. Oftentimes when we're conducting investigations, we'll conduct the search warrant at a house, for example. We may not be arresting the person as they're in the middle of investigation, working through to build enough evidence to do just that. And if, say, for example, I think the example we used in committee originally, if we find some drugs in one room, for example, but we find a large amount of cash in another, that there would be a challenge to seize that. I think the discussion was as to whether or not that currency would be considered contraband that we would seize as evidence. I think the bill as written from all of our perspective creates some significant challenges for us in seizing it on the front end to even initiate the forfeiture proceedings. And then pragmatically speaking, if we were to initiate the forfeiture proceedings under this bill in court, the odds, if it is a true drug ring, of finding that money later on after we get the correct process would be very challenging for us to do.
Ripson Mueller. You know, one example that I think I used in past years in committee was a client that I had a few years ago who had loaned her car to her boyfriend who had taken cash to unbank or something to get a money order. It was $1,300. The car got stopped because of a bad taillight. The guy that he was given a ride to had a vial of cough syrup that they seized on suspicion of a felony that it was illegal cough syrup. Turned out not to be, but they kept her car and her cash for over a year. Ramsey County did. She got evicted because she couldn't make rent in March of 3 years ago. They took her car and they kept her car for a year too. Part of the problem, I think, of the reason this language is in there is that there was no reason for her to tank her rent money and get her evicted, but they did because they could. And so the language states, listen, you got to have like some reason beyond just the fact that they have cash on them to do that. Any other questions for Mr. Hutton? Ripson Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To Superintendent Evans, so just based on some of the testimony and what we're looking at, this is a major, you know, replacing of a big part of of what law enforcement does. Would you say that allowing, if there was an opportunity to allow for some more time to pause and take a closer look at this, would that be advantageous to law enforcement to take a closer look at the forfeiture law and have a chance to look at this more closely before diving into such a major change?
Who was that for? Was that for Mr. Hutton or Mr.
Mr. Evans.
Mr. Evans, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I know that some ongoing conversations are having just, you know, along your original question to Mr. Hutton in terms of what pieces could we look at to address, and I know we've had conversations with the Chair about what pieces could, as to make sure that just what he had noted, that the proper procedure and proper process in place, that we aren't holding people's money and property for extended period of times without process and then eventually get them back, just the example that he used. And so we have been having those conversations to figure out within the current confines of the law or other pieces to make sure that you know, innocent owners, citizens, they're not needlessly losing their money. And so I know some of those conversations are rapidly occurring to have discussions that make sure the right protections are in place for Minnesotans.
Okay. Representative Johnson, Chair Johnson.
Chair Lesh, members, this is more of a comment again. For some reason I like doing comments today.
All such.
Chair Lesh, the example you used 2 years ago, we took care of that issue with the innocent owner law. We changed the forfeiture statutes dealing with that issue. But for the members that don't know, on the last few months, we've had two major court rulings come out on the forfeiture laws, changing them dramatically. And they need to be, those court rulings need to be studied carefully and thoroughly to make sure that we do, when we change this statute, we change it to follow the current rulings of the Supreme Court. I'm already just glancing through this. I found one violation of the Supreme Court's ruling in this new statute. That's under the DWI laws. So I think we need to do a pause and maybe put together a task force to really dig in, look into it, and make sure that when you come back, we do things properly.
Well, Chair Johnson, the Timms decision that came down in February, all that did was apply the Eighth Amendment prohibition against cruel and unusual punishment to the states under the 14th Amendment. That supposedly, I think we did take care of in the 2014 piece, the 2014 changes that we did on forfeiture, but I don't think it made any other changes or requirements of us as a state. In that case, they found, what, a couple grams of heroin on the guy, and they took his $50,000 car as an instrumentality of a crime, and the Supreme Court, on a 9-0 case, found that that was excessive fines. But I would just point that out. I don't think it changes it as much as you suggest it does, but reasonable minds might be able to disagree. Chair Johnson.
Chair Lesh, I would have to disagree with you on that because in this bill, gross misdemeanor, you can take a $100,000 vehicle in your bill, which is would be excessive.
Well, Chair Johnson, you know, all we're doing is not changing that part of what we already changed. That is now an official prohibition. We're not saying that you can do that. We're also saying we're not saying that you can't do that. The U.S. Supreme Court said you can't do that under the Eighth Amendment and the 14th. But I don't think this bill expressly permits that. I don't think we're in a position to cinch everything down perfectly. But Chair Johnson,
you know, I'm not a lawyer. I'm just reading what's in the bill. One thing the Supreme Court said is cruel and unusual, but we still have the issue with that on the DWI statutes. That's why I think we need to really look in, make sure we do it properly.
Representative Grussell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and for Superintendent Evans, if you'd come back down.
So you get paid the big bucks.
That's right.
Go ahead, Representative Russell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Superintendent Evans. What are the effects, I guess, you know, what are the effects, can you explain a little bit on, let's say, narcotics trafficking when seizures are done?
Superintendent Evans.
Mr. Chair, Representative Grassl, and members, I do think, and that's part of the reason from our perspective at the BCA why we seize cash currency related to drug investigations. I think the example we've used before is, for example, right now methamphetamine in streets of Mexico, which is where a lot of our methamphetamine is coming from, is wholesaling at approximately $200 a pound. In Minnesota, it's wholesaling for approximately $3,500 a pound here, which is much lower than it's been in the past. Supply, demand, just like any other business. If that profit and that money goes back to Mexico, even if a profit is pulled off for the cartels as they operate much like businesses do, that an amount of that is going to be put back into product to be sent back up to further their business model and sell more drugs into our streets in Minnesota. So we do feel that seizing cash currency from our drug trafficking organizations is a very important tool so that they do not have the illicit proceeds to further the criminal trade that they're engaged in. And so that is the purpose behind why we seize the drug currency. They are very sophisticated in how they traffic their currency back and forth. Oftentimes the drugs are coming up in one load car and the currency is going back in another. They're not always being trafficked together because they certainly know what law enforcement efforts are and how they are operating, how we operate as a law enforcement organization. So they take many steps to hide those illicit proceeds.
Representative Grassl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Superintendent. Again, another little bit. How do these forfeitures assist the Minnesota BCA? How do these forfeitures assist sheriff's offices, police departments, etc.?
Superintendent Evans.
Mr. Chair, Representative Grassl, and members, the BCA uses all of the seizures that for forfeitures that we have for overtime funding for our agents. Due to the nature of the investigations the BCA conducts, it's often not plausible for us to just send additional agents out in the middle of a long-term investigation in the middle of the night where they've been working. And so we do have to pay their overtime funds. That's what we use the funds for because it's just not plausible to add additional people to that. So it's being directly pushed back into the investigations we're conducting across the BCA. I don't want to speak for law enforcement, but I know they do many of the same things. They also use for equipment purchases that are valuable to conducting criminal investigations across Minnesota, but I won't speak for them.
Any other questions?
Chair? Sorry, Mr. Chair.
Representative Grassl.
A couple more things. If that,
go ahead.
How does that help your agencies?
Mr. Hutton.
Mr. Chair, Representatives, very similar. Overtime protective equipment for law enforcement officers if they're going on meth labs or grows or anything like that. Overtime testing equipment for narcotics as well. So I will say that each and every penny goes back into crime fighting.
Thank you, Representative Grassl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so I guess what I'm getting at is to hinder this, to hamstring law enforcement, would that put resources back into the hands of traffickers, and would it take it away from law enforcement in order to, you know, to keep our streets clean, our people safe on while they're in the process of enforcing the law? I mean, either one of you could answer that,
Mr. Hutton.
Mr. Chair, that'd be our fear, right? If this law were to go as written here, that would be the fear that we would have, that the monies would continue and we wouldn't be able to be as disruptive as we are currently, the way things are.
Representative Grassl.
Mr. Chair, I spent 6 years on a narcotics, violent crime, and gang task force that was joined by the Minnesota BCA, and a lot of the resources that came from seizures and forfeitures acted as a force multiplier for small agencies like the one that I came from that had one deputy that they could spare to go and cover a 5-county, 3-reservation area. If these are some things that are going to be taken away from law enforcement, then the burden of keeping up this fight is going to fall on the taxpayers, I would assume. So if there's a way to pull back on the reins like they're asking and do some more careful looking at this, it's going to benefit everybody. It's going to help law enforcement to continue to do their job safely, have the resources that they need, and keep our kids, keep the narcotics, hopefully, and so on, out of the hands of our students, our kids, so on. And to, you know, it's I'm hoping that let's pull back on it, do some more careful looking at this bill before they pull the trigger on it, because, you know, it's not an easy gig out there.
Any other questions for Mr. Evans or Mr. Hutton? Oh, yeah, that's right. Chair Johnson, go ahead again.
I just wanted to thank Superintendent Evans. I've worked narcotics, done the 45, 50-hour days, and without their agents coming to assist us, it would be brutal. And they've been fantastic to work with. I also want to relay a story that I just learned Tuesday night at one of my small cities city council meeting. The police department was able to purchase the three new tough books they needed for their squad cars. They've been trying to figure out how to fund them for 3 years. About 6 months ago, they had a pursuit, a gentleman fleeing that had multiple warrants. They were able to forfeit the vehicle, and the funds they got from that forfeited vehicle was the only way they were able to purchase their new computers for their squad cars.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. Chair Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, but I think the last two lines of questioning show the basic problem of the forfeiture law is that you sometimes have a conflict of interest as far, I mean, don't know all the cases of the thing you just said, but they needed three new tough books for their cars. Okay, there's a car we can confiscate. We've got it. It's done. You know, and sometimes I have no idea. I'm not going to accuse anybody of doing something like that. But the perception then from the communities is they needed some money, so they did some forfeitures. And if we're going, what we should be doing is funding our police departments and the BCA at the levels they need, not sending them out trying to find money in other areas.
Mr. Chair. Well, listen, here's the deal. I mean, I don't want to get in a ping pong debate. There might be an amendment or something we can debate on Marco with an amendment or something. But let me ask you this, Mr. Hutton. Do you think forfeitures is an optimal way to fund law enforcement?
Mr. Chair, representatives, optimum?
Optimal.
Optimal? Gosh, no. If we're thinking that we had all the money in the world, give us the money for what we need. But is it a tool that we use? It's not just about the forfeiture. Is it a tool that we use to disrupt? I think that the example the superintendent used, that's a tool that we use. I mean, individuals are, I think when I was working dope, we were paying $15,000 a pound. And as you can see, the supply and demand went down, and so that money's going back to Mexico, purchasing pounds of methamphetamine for $200 a pound. And then that's just that cycle that just keeps coming back. I'm mixing a couple things there, Mr. Chair, but hopefully you understand my message.
I do. I think we hear loud and clear from law enforcement, don't take this money from us because we use it for good stuff, which I don't doubt that. But members, the principle I think brought up by Chair Considine is really important. The perception that this eat what you kill is motivating how law enforcement acts is a real problem. And I've seen it in a few cases, and I'm sure that's not the majority. but I still have heartburn over what I saw that indigent woman go through a few years ago at the hands of Ramsey County, who did it because they could. Because they could. There was no motivation to really dig into the injustice that happened to this individual, because as soon as you're in the system, you're the bad guy. That's who you are. And maybe we'll look at it if there were powerful people that ask a lot of questions, and maybe we still won't. Meanwhile, she's homeless, loses her job, loses her car, and God, that's bad news. So you're talking about these big bad guys with the Sinaloa cartel who are bad, and we appreciate your work on them, and we're talking about these innocent people, or who should be innocent people, who, you know, are getting hosed. So I will say that I agree with you. I think law enforcement should be funded. Absolutely. I'd like to find a way to do that where law enforcement is funded fairly. But this body, this committee in particular, still has some institutional memory over the events of 12, 13 years ago with the strike force and how things went wrong there. Unfortunately, I think you're bearing some of the brunt of that collective memory of what happened back then. So, last comment or question, Representative Grossel?
I was just going to, I think you pretty much covered it, Mr. Chair, that law enforcement doesn't go out tracking people to buy computers. They go out to enforce the law. And, you know, I just take a little exception with that last comment from Chair Considine, because that's not what the majority of law enforcement does, if any of them. We go out there, we enforce the law. If the vehicle is required to be forfeited, then they forfeit it. If it needs to be given back, then give it back. We're looking at these cases here as far as the value of these seizures and forfeitures as far as benefiting the fight against a lot of these things, a lot of these major crimes, and to put that money back into the hands of those who are feeding on our citizens. That's not the way to do it, as far as I'm concerned. To keep that money flowing so that we keep some of the burden off of taxpayers. I mean, it'd be great if we could fund them full, but that'll never be to where we can fight that. We're fighting an unfair fight because they have millions, we have hundreds of thousands to fight with. So any resource that we can use to fight back against these this onslaught against our friends, our families, our children, that's the resources we gotta be able to use. These cases like you just talked about, I mean, let's handle those cases, but let's not kick everything to the curb just because we have a couple cases that weren't done correctly that needed to be corrected. So I mean, that's the consideration that I hope gets taken here.
That's the last word. Thank you very much, gentlemen, for coming down. And members, this bill has amendments that are due on Monday at 10 a.m. And I know that the bill is perfect and doesn't need any changes, but to the extent that anyone does just have a harebrained idea to offer an amendment, that they're due on Monday at 10. Thank you, members. That is the end of the walkthrough. There being no other business before the committee is adjourned.